that's actually where the impact is. If you can have this intersection of a big clinical need with a commercial opportunity, you can actually make that come into reality. And that really changes patient care.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the UCSF Rosamond Institute in San Francisco. Our guest today is Gabriel Sanchez, the CEO and co-founder of Inspectra Health. If you ever had a skin biopsy, you'll appreciate that Inspectra is developing a non-invasive way to take digital images of the skin without ever making a single cut. In the images, clinicians will be able to look at cells to diagnose or rule out conditions like basal skin carcinoma. The images are live and real time, which reminds me of some Star Trek technology. A little bit of Gabriel. Gabriel grew up in rural New Mexico, where he had to drive himself to school the moment he was allowed to drive. He would start on dirt roads from the ranch where he lived, that's 60 miles each way, every day. And that is dedication to learning. Gabriel is also the 2018 Rosamond Innovators, and his company Inspectra recently raised an $8 million Series A round. And if you're interested in how to interact with investors, Gabriel will share some of his wisdom in this episode. If you'd like to hear more about the UCSF Rosamond Institute, please visit us at rosamondinstitute.org. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Well, thank you, Gabriel, for coming today.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. This is really exciting.
I'm really excited for you to share your story with our community.
Absolutely.
You've done a really amazing thing. And maybe we can start from, I know that you're from New Mexico. We had brief conversation a while back about growing up in the city versus growing up in the rural area.
Yes.
And we always think that childhood shaped who you are too a little bit. Maybe you can tell us about what's like growing up in New Mexico.
It does. Well, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to share. You know, it's funny, it's very different. So I did grow up very rural. I would say extremely rural in this, on a cattle ranch in New Mexico. So it was really just me and my family. And outside of the cities, I was fortunate enough to go to the private school in the city, the Catholic school, which was college prep and had very high quality, but that's like 65 miles away. So usually what people ask me is like, did you drive it? And I was like, yes, I drove it both ways. And it's like, yeah, I didn't sleep there. You know, I came back, right? You know, so it's easier to drive there. Although, the first 10 miles or so are dirt roads. So it takes a little while.
But you did not drive. Somebody else have to drive.
No,
you.
I drove. My parents were very motivated for me to get my driver's license so that I could drive because they didn't want to commute. So I got it, the second I turned 16, I was careening down the road in a 2,000-pound, weapon for 65 miles, right? But yeah, it's very different, So it was, farm life and cattle life. It's a different pace. I worked a lot with my hands and sort of became sort of the Mr. Fix-It of the farm. I would repair the equipment, the machinery. I wasn't that gifted as a writer, frankly. So I didn't do as much of the cattle work and did a little more of the operational stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had a mechanical knack for it. But mm-hmm. I was also at the same time, very academically studious and interested in learning and always gravitated towards the science and math, mm-hmm. got pulled into that direction. And, come graduation time, throughout a few Hail Marys to some big name colleges, I got into MIT.
Right.
And so that was a big transition. So, I do hear, we did have this conversation about culture shock. I hear about students talking about, I went from Chicago to Boston,
right,
or Minneapolis to San Francisco. But I was like, that's easy. I mean, come on, I went from, like six people on a 5,000 acre ranch, uh-huh, to downtown Boston, right? And that was, it was very, very different.
What was that like?
That was interesting. So it's funny, sometimes I talk to my parents about it. So they gave me $100, put me on a plane and said, go figure it out. And that was it. And I was fortunate to be in a summer program for pre-freshmen to, to get to see the campus, take some classes, get ahead of the coursework a little bit. And when I showed up, you know, I just showed up by myself with all my bags or whatever, but there were like parents and grandparents there, and they're all crying and dropping their kids off. And I was just sort of like, well, I had $100, I told you. I spent $40 on the cab to get to campus. I was like, oh, this is going to be a little tricky. So, but it all worked out, you know? It's like, it's always been the case. Like, I've always just been, you jump into the deep end, it's uncomfortable, you get used to it, and it all works out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That must be quite an eye-opening when you see how...
I just remember staring at the buildings. You know, New Mexico's flat and sprawling, and you can see the sky without looking up. Mm-hmm. Like, so that was actually, I remember, shocking to me, because I had never lifted my head to look to the sky, because the horizon is always in front of you. And when I was in the city, the only place you can see any semblance of the atmosphere is up through the tall buildings. And that was very odd for me. I hadn't really used those muscles in the back of my neck. So it was a surprise, you know. But then the university was so fantastic. It was just like the best technical learning environment, you know, people learning just for the sake of learning, trying to innovate, change the world in impactful and meaningful ways through technology. It's just a spirit of innovation there that's fantastic.
Obviously, I mean, your parents raised you to be really independent.
Yeah.
And so it helps you to navigate a bigger city, probably.
Yeah.
And a bigger school.
Yeah, I also got lucky, too. I met my girlfriend, but my wife, my freshman year at MIT, and she's much more savvy and street smart than I am. So I kind of clinged on to her, and then she helped me, you know, slowly integrate into society, which was really helpful.
Yeah. What do you mean by integrate into society?
Well, just, you know, I had just grown up, you know, so rural and outside of most of the norms of, you know, I didn't know any of the music, the television shows, didn't really know anything about city life, you know, crossing streets it's simple stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, it sounds so simple, but if you haven't been around it, you just don't really think about these things.
Yeah.
The first time that it rained in Boston, so it started pouring, and I didn't have any gear because I didn't know anything about that. And in New Mexico, it rains in the summer, you have the monsoon rains, and they'll rain hard for 10 minutes and then disappear. And so I was like, I'll just wait here till it stops, you know. And I was there like 3 hours later, and it was still going. And I was like, I'm going to have to get soaked. It doesn't look like it's stopping, you know. And then I just remember I ran to my dorm. I was soaked. I went to sleep, and then it was raining in the morning. I was like, I can't believe it started raining again. But it had never stopped. It was just, it was continuous. I've never seen that much water, right? So it's funny things like that.
Yeah.
But I slowly, you know, it's good to broaden your horizons.
Yeah. Right, right. So, yeah. I think moving to a new place
definitely
force you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's good to always be just almost tripping a little bit. You don't want to be too comfortable. You know, you just want to grow. You want to learn.
Right.
Add something new to your experience or your skill set.
Do you think that your parents' upbringing kind of give you that comfort nurse? It's okay to trip a little bit and not knowing everything.
No, they definitely would let me trip a lot. You know, because you can take it. You know, I think they were always pushing me. You know, my dad used to always say that nothing in my life will be easy, because if it gets easy, you just bite off more, you mm-hmm. know? And so, you know, if things are easy for you, you're probably underperforming. So so we were always just kind of just trying to take a little bit further, you know? And I got kind of just comfortable with discomfort in a way.
So from MIT, you did your graduate study at Stanford. So it's another big city in a coast.
That's a similar thing. So actually, that was one of my big decisions at that time, was did I want to stay at MIT, which I loved, or did I want to maybe branch out and go to another new environment, a different university, and not just a new city, but different ways of learning and different attitudes towards innovation. And MIT and Stanford are both extremely innovative, but in very different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was motivated by my undergraduate advisor, Ian Hunter, Professor Hunter, where I was lucky to get into research early in my sophomore year, and I had worked in the labs, and he runs a bioinstrumentation lab, which was really where I started to first get the flavor that you could actually apply standard engineering disciplines and principles into the world of medicine and biology. And he didn't really mince words. He was like, you'll be underselling yourself if you don't get a PhD, and I really think you should. And that really lit a fire under me. I'd never known anybody who'd gone to grad school, so I don't know anything about it, but I'm like, yeah, you know, let's try it out. So I applied to some schools, you know, and I got in. And my wife also, so she was still at that time my girlfriend, but she also got in at Stanford. And so we both came to Stanford for grad school. And she's a civil engineer, structural engineer, and I'm a mechanical. And so then I come to Stanford to do a master's and PhD in mechanical engineering as well.
Okay. And that's where it led to what you're working on right now.
Eventually. Even that, yeah, there are a few steps in there.
Okay,
so,
yeah.
So what's funny was, so one of the most interesting things, so I go to Stanford and I'm interested now a little bit in medical technology and thinking about mostly doing research. In my mind, I was going academic. I thought that I would do research, get the PhD. Maybe I would become a professor and run a lab or something. It just seemed fascinating to me. And in my first year there at Stanford, I got this email that went out to the entire Mechie department from this program called the Biodesign Program, which I'd never heard about. And they said, hey, we have these fellows, these are professionals that come in, they work on these really important clinical needs and they're developing solutions and they need technical support. They're gonna actually have an additional year fellowship and they were looking for some engineers who wanna help out. And so I went and this is the first time I met Tom Crummell. This would have been 2006, so this is 13 years ago. And I went and interviewed with all the Biodesign people, Polyhawk and everyone. And then they pulled me in and I got course credit for helping the Biodesign fellows design technologies. And that actually was really what gave me my first insight into sort of the commercialization of medical technologies and how important that is, that's actually where the impact is. If you can have this intersection of a big clinical need with a commercial opportunity, you can actually make that come into reality. And that really changes patient care. So, you know, I worked on a laparoscopic closure device, a congestive heart failure device, even some contact lens technology. Notes was that this like this hot space for like a year or two of this like natural orifice surgery, right? So I worked in those sorts of things while I was getting my master's.
Okay.
But then I still wanted to do my PhD. So I jumped into a lab, which is Scott Delp's lab. And that's actually what laid the foundation eventually for the technology even that we still use today.
Okay. So it's kind of like with that particular program where you get all the credit, it's almost like you work in a consulting firm that you see so many technology.
Sort of. Yeah. I think they call me a biodesign contributor. I was never in the fellowship, you know, but I thought of it as like an engineer in residence, sort of, with a whole bunch of almost primordial startups. Like they hadn't even launched yet, you know, and they're like doing all this basic stuff. So I would like do, you know, prototyping and bench testing and design work with them, you know, searching patents, things like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so it was, just for units.
You got all the training before you start this.
It was great.
Company.
Yeah. Well, it got me really excited that I wanted to take the fellowship. I guess we'll get there, but I never got the chance to take it. But I jumped into my PhD and I was like, okay, I'm going to finish up the PhD. But I got hired right out of my PhD to teach at Stanford. So Stanford was starting an undergraduate bioengineering program. They'd always had a graduate program, and they wanted to develop curriculum for the undergrads and basically teach like an undergrad biodesign. And I got pulled in and hired by the department. So I was a teaching faculty for 2 years. So I basically taught the biodesign process and developed curriculum for lab skills and prototyping and the senior capstone courses, but then I never got the chance to really go into the program.
You'd be the contributor.
Yeah, I contributed. That's right. Because then while I was doing that, I had been incubating on the side this idea of actually leveraging my PhD work and maybe pulling that out of the university. And so after I had taught for a few years, I went ahead and made the leap and jumped into running the company full time.
Yeah.
And that would have been like late 2014.
Okay. Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based med tech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into a unique healthcare solution. For more information, visit their website at iolifescience.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
So maybe for the listener who don't know, can you describe to us like what's the technology that you do and what's that?
Sure, and it's even evolved quite a bit since my work at Stanford. But when I got to Stanford, I met Professor Scott Delp, who was running. He runs a neuromuscular biomechanics lab, and they study human movement, and it's based on computer simulations of how muscles work, and it's all based on assumptions of what the biology does, which basically comes down to this thing called a sarcomere, which is the subcellular contractile thing in muscle that pulls, and it makes everything shrink. And it's in skeletal muscle, it's in heart muscle, it's in smooth muscle. Mm-hmm. And all of our knowledge of that structure basically comes from half a dozen cadavers that were studied back in the 80s, and all of our simulations are built on that. But we know, or at least we suspected, that cadaver tissue is probably not representative of living tissue. We know that the body goes through rigor mortis. The fixing process shrinks the structures. And a lot of how that motor, that biomotor behaves, depends on its length and how it overlaps. So there's been this dream in muscle physiology of studying sarcomeres inside the body. And at the same time, Scott had been working on this. There was a new professor there, Mark Schnitzer, who had been developing these miniature imaging techniques for imaging in mice brains using these microneedle lenses. And so they had this vision of maybe we could combine the two together. And actually, there was a student there before me, Mike Llewellyn, who had showed you could do this. The only problem is you have to use this piece of equipment that's about the size of your kitchen, right? So it's a massive thing. So you can kind of force someone under there under really difficult conditions. You can get some measurements, but it's not really useful clinically. And so I saw that as like fundamentally just a design problem. I was like, if we can implement the same type of imaging, but in a clinically deployable format, we can get live measurements on these muscles and study their contractile behavior. So I ended up making something called a multiphoton microscope, which is an imaging technique that causes tissue to illuminate itself, basically. You excite it with near-infrared light, and it regurgitates the energy as visible light in the visible spectrum. And you can get pictures from that. And so I found a way to implement that in ultra-miniature format through these needles, and we actually got the first-ever measurements of contractility of sarcomeres in living bodies. And we published a paper, mm-hmm. and there was some excitement there. There's a nice scientific need. There wasn't a lot of immediate clinical application for that because actually no one had ever studied it. And we were the only ones who had ever taken pictures. And so even at the time, there was a lot of debate whether that was even real because those measurements differed a little bit from the cadaver measurements. And people were more inclined to trust the cadaver than actual pictures of mm-hmm. the living structure for some reason. So it became a battle. And I realized that this was going to be a decade of like uh-huh. science work. So we took a step back and we said, well, what we have done here, though, is we have solved a imaging problem that's actually people have been working on for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't just image muscle. Like, you can actually image a lot of different right. structures with this. So let's go, this is going back to the biodesign training. It's like, let's go find some needs, but it's I'd call it a filtered needs finding process, where I said, let's go find needs where the crux of those problems is in cellular imaging, and then we'll design mm-hmm. a solution for that. Because really what was most valuable out of that whole process was that we had built the knowledge mm-hmm. of how to design these systems custom and miniaturized. Right. And so we looked at everything from, surgical repair of muscles for strabismus to intraoperative surgical guidance, mm-hmm. Tumor resection, bedside, histopath. And we kept kind of coming to dermatology and oncology, where there's this whole field based on slide-based pathology. Basically imaging slides and looking for the cancers. Mm-hmm. And it's all the decisions and the entire workflow is based on that. And it's actually an extremely cumbersome process. Mm-hmm. But if we could make a portable, non-invasive version of a microscope that could image that, that's where the value would be. Yeah. So that started that process. And so what we have now, that's a long answer, but what we have is a microscope that doesn't need slides, basically. So this is a portable device. You touch it to the skin. It looks under the skin, through the layers, in color, down to the cellular scale. And you see the same structures you would see on a slide, but in real time. And you know, we're compressing a five-day process into a few seconds.
And you don't have to get cut.
And you don't have to get cut. It's magical. Yeah.
It looks like a miracle, I think.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I think it's like ultrasound for the cells. You know, I mean, it's a huge leap forward. You know, if you just think about, it's such a hindrance to have to make slides. It's always been that way. So, you know, you have to cut tissue out, slice it about a tenth of the thickness of a piece of paper, put it flat onto a slide, stain it, and then you look at it.
Right.
And we forget that the looking at it is the diagnosis part. We always call the biopsy the diagnosis, but that's just unfortunately a necessary inconvenience that we have to go through to get the slide.
Yeah.
That process of cutting, slicing, mounting, staining, looking hasn't changed for 150 years.
Yeah.
So this is a space that has completely resisted innovation. And if you could change that, if we could suddenly make like the values in the image, or you could suddenly make the image accessible and it's digital and it's shareable and it's like, you know, you can analyze it, right? I mean, that really changes the way we think about histopathology.
Yeah. So how long it took you to get to where, to identify this is the target area that you want to
We were interested in skin very early on. We did a bunch of market research and kind of the needs evaluation process that we learned through school. And but we had to, you know, I believed it. I could see in my mind how this would all come together, but I didn't have to convince myself. I had to convince the investors. And they didn't have as much vision as I had. You know, they can see as far as what we could put in front of them, right? So I'm like, okay, well, we got to find a way to step this along. So we raised some seed money. We built basically a table version to show the basic principle. And then of course, wanted to see if we could deploy this in miniature. And so we made a small version. And then ultimately, we made a full clinical prototype. And we ran a little pilot study out of El Camino Hospital to prove, in fact, that we can see these tumors before you cut them out of the body. And now that process would have been, it's about 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we had that, and we were like, okay, now we're ready. And then we spent a little over a year trying to fundraise. Yeah, so, yeah.
That's the life of an entrepreneur.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like
that's
doing
right.
a lot of the fundraise. So how many patients' data have you had so far?
So we have, through that pilot, we imaged something like 34 people. Most of them were healthy volunteers, because this was partially funded by the National Cancer Institutes. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we really wanted to show was that this technology would work in anybody. So we actually imaged, you know, children from as young as 5 up to senior citizens, 85 years old, all across the body, all different skin colors and skin types. And so most of the, you know, 23 or so of those participants were just healthy people that spanned a broad range of skin. And we proved that you can actually get these images in anybody. And then we did a handful of patients from the clinic, about 10.
Mm-hmm.
They were selected for biopsy based on suspicion of basal cell carcinoma, which is the most common skin cancer. Only half of them actually have the cancer. That's pretty normal statistics. About half the biopsies come out benign. But then, so then we had 5 people where they actually had tumors, and you know, we had images of those tumors. So it's very compelling in a small data set as like case examples of what we can do. And that was enough to motivate, you know, confidence that if we scaled this up and we did this in a true clinical trial, we're going to be able to get the results we want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, recently you completed your last race.
Yes.
$8 million.
Yes.
And so now is the time to spend that money.
Now we're spending. Yeah.
More work. Yeah. What are the things that you're trying to achieve that you need to achieve?
Yeah, so our focus is really on FDA clearance. So there is a predicate technology and a 510K pathway that we can take. It doesn't, it gets us really a good foot in the door to start building evidence. I think of it as dipping a toe in a much larger pool so we can expand from there, but it's a really good place to get started. And so working backwards from that, then what we have to do is basically we have one prototype. This is the only thing in the world that does it. I think it's amazing, but we need to make it manufacturable and make a small batch, and then we're going to run that batch through design controls and quality, and then release that for a clinical trial. And then we're going to do the big clinical trial to support the clearance.
That's exciting.
It's very exciting. Yeah.
I mean, when I first tried it, I thought it feels like a Star Trek-y a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. I appreciate that because I'm a big fan of Star Trek, so that means a lot to me to have you say that.
Yeah, I was like, wow, yeah. This is Star Trek become real.
Yeah, or like the magic school bus, you know? It's like you put it on and you dive inside and you're watching like all these little cells and subcellular things flickering around.
Right. Everything.
It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. I remember coming home, I was like, wow, that was really awesome.
Yeah, we always try to, if we can get people, the only limitation is we had just the one, but like if we could get somebody to see it, like it makes sense like that.
Right.
Like that makes sense. Sometimes when you're explaining it arbitrarily without seeing the technology, it's like, oh, okay, it's a camera, it takes a picture of the skin, whatever. It's not the same thing. Like, you really have to see it in action.
I think what you're working on is so unique, so it's hard for people to kind of wrap around it.
Yeah.
It's just seeing it is believing it.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to see it.
Yeah. And how do you face that challenge when you're going for raising money, right?
That's really hard. I mean, that's the crux of the problem, isn't it? Right? Like I said, I could... Being familiar with the technology, knowing how this could evolve, I could see how, you know, what we had done in the early phases would show that we could get to where we needed to. But if you're not deep in that space and you don't know a lot about it, it's not entirely clear, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's really, and that really boils down, I think, to my primary job as a CEO is like I have to communicate the vision, but then I also need enough ammunition and progress to be able to span that gap, right? So one of the things I'm always doing is I'm always looking at, you know, what value milestones can we hit with the resources we have? You know, when we were raising seed money, we were very successful in bringing in seed money, but it's always a few $100,000 at a time. You mean, not a big enough bolus to bite, you know, a big trial off or something. So I'm always thinking about how can we got to lay down some stones, we can skip across the river, you know, If we can get to this phase, you know, that'll build enough confidence to get us to the next phase and to the next phase. And we always had this, this primary milestone in mind of like, if we can show that we can miniaturize this on the bench, we'll be able to get a few more $100,000 to go get a clinical version. And then if we can get the clinical version, we'll get a handful of data. And with that data, so I'm always like, it's like crossing the country, you know, where you can drive 100 miles at a time. And it really changes the way you would drive across the country, but eventually you do reach the middle of the country and you can't cross that distance, right? So, you know, you need to trade in and get a car that's got a bigger range, right? That's where we have to raise the big round.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a little bit of, you know, it's just a little bit of thinking ahead, planning the cadence of the milestones and thinking of, you know, you have to talk to a lot of people. So we would always talk to investors even before we were ready.
Right.
You got to balance that. But I want to see how they react to it and what we're missing. And get a sense for what they're looking for, what's going to flip their decision.
Right.
And so we're doing all of that all the time.
Yeah. Right? No, I think by now you have that network.
Yeah.
And when they keep seeing the progress that you make, they'll be killing themselves. How come I didn't come in earlier?
Well, that's it's funny you bring that up. So networking is so critical. I'm sure we'll talk about this more. But one of the things you just mentioned, which is a big challenge, is when we're first going out there, we're kind of coming in cold. So they're just evaluating exactly what they see in front of them. We don't get a lot of credit for the milestones we've already accomplished because we hadn't told them about it like a year ago or anything, right? And they always just want whatever you don't have. They're like, oh yeah, that's great, but have you done, you know, what's your sensitivity and specificity in a blinded RCT study? It's like, well, you know, we don't have that, right? That's what we're raising the money for. So one of the things that I think we have an opportunity now is now that we have made progress and we do have resources and people are aware of where we're at, when we hit these next milestones, we'll actually get credit for all of that. And that I think is very important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does take a village.
It takes a village, yeah.
To make this moving forward. So before we run out of our time, I always like to ask, maybe before I ask for the book list, maybe if I ask you to give two advice for entrepreneurs.
Two advice.
I know, I usually say three, so I said two.
I only get two. Well, that's harder. Well, maybe no one can see this. I'm thinking. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll give you one. This is relevant given the recent 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. So as a kid, I was very inspired by space and space travel. And one of the things that really pushed me into engineering was really the work done in studying the solar system. And, you know, I'd watched the Apollo 13 movie. That was actually very influential to me. And when I watched the Apollo 13 movie, I went on my 13th birthday, 1995. And I left there realizing that the moon is only halfway. And this is important. This changed my whole way of thinking about life. So those astronauts are very interested in getting to the moon, but they wanted to come back alive, mm-hmm. right? And so sometimes what you see out there as what you think is the end and the big milestone is only part of the way. And in fact, the journey is a lot more treacherous and arduous than you might mm-hmm. anticipate. So that's maybe a perspective in perseverance. You know, yeah. It's just like, pick any analogy, you know, Everest, whatever. I mean, I think about, oh, we got to get FDA clearance, you know, but that's just starting, right? You know, so the moon's only halfway. Maybe another one I'll share another. This is an oldie, but a goodie. And for me, I changed my perspective on it as well as I learned a little bit, which is strike the iron when it's hot. Like everybody talks about that. Growing up, I had heard that saying all the time. And I just thought that was, you know, when an opportunity presents itself, you know, take advantage of it, right? Like just be opportunistic. But I took a material science course in undergrad where we did some metallurgy and smelting. And I learned the source of that is just that when you're actually hitting iron, if it's not hot, it doesn't deform, right? You know, so you got to hit the iron when it's hot to actually move it and shape it. But what changed in my perspective was that I heat the iron. So I became much more active. I was like, I can actually influence the environment to facilitate my success, basically play to my strengths. Mm-hmm. Things like networking, building relationships, picking the right milestones. So I think of it more as like, prepare the conditions and then go and strike the iron and be successful. And I think that's a lot more active and mm-hmm. less passive and maybe a better perspective.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I like that analogy a lot. Yeah. So, last question.
Okay.
Book.
Books. I don't read. No. Yeah. I read a book just because I knew you were going to ask this question. So I just read this book, Loon Shots.
Oh, I heard about this.
Yeah.
I've not read it, but somebody told me.
It was good. Yeah. So it's about, it's about crazy, way out there ideas and how, you know, how to try to help them survive the gauntlet of criticism and failures that you're inevitably going to face along the way and make sure that they can actually, develop and mm-hmm. and impact society. And it was very interesting. He uses an analogy of like phase transitions and things. It's a good book. I thought it was, I mostly like the historical context because they go through a lot of the historical, what we would call loon shots that have really influenced society. And I like to see that. And then I have another book on the list. My wife just got, I don't usually read fiction, but she got me this book called, I think it's The Last Days of Night. It's a new book. It's a semi-fictional tale of the battle for light between, you know, Edison and Westinghouse, and Tesla's in there. And it's a true event and it's real characters and environment, but kind of with a bit of a fictional flair on like what would it have been like to be, you know, fighting to rule the world, to bring light into the world or something.
Exciting.
So it sounds really great.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's good. Well, thank you so much.
I absolutely enjoyed it. It was my pleasure. I hope that helps.
No, this is really fun. This is good. I'm so happy to share that with everybody because what you're doing is really amazing and cool.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.